Thank you, Leah. It's always great to be in St. Georgia and to tell you about my life. So, this is something we just did, and actually was inspired by a discussion here when I was last year was here at the program. I was chatting with Lucas, and Lucas told me all these protein faces, and so I went back and worked with Barak and Suji and Flo, who are students and postdocs at IQIM, and we came up with this idea of using the matrix product formalism to represent localities of the universe. So let me tell you about what it is all about. So matrix product, usually we use it in the sense of matrix product states. Matrix product states have been a very successful framework to represent and also study one-dimensional wave functions. So it's not just any one-dimensional wave function, it's the set of wave functions that can be individually written in this way that we can expand it in a basis and write the coefficient in front of each of the bases as a trace among a bunch of matrices. So this is a very limited way to write wave functions, but it turns out that because we're using this one-dimensional structure, we're putting a set of matrices for each one lattice, that we're capturing the dimensionality of the structure in the state, that we can use fewer than necessary parameters to capture the whole structure of the system. So graphically, what people usually draw this kind of diagram where we the vertical indexes, the physical index, and the horizontal ones are the ones for the matrices and connected left to right. And the nice thing about this matrix state representation is that it provides a highly useful way to represent one-dimensional ground state, especially for interacting systems. So usually if we talk about free system, there's a very efficient representation, but whenever we introduce interactions, it seems that the representation has to be exponentially complicated. But it turns out that if the interactions are local and they satisfy nice properties, we're looking at states at low energy, then this matrix product representation provides a highly efficient representation of those class of states as well. And the whole story actually started before we had any analytical, before we had a good analytical understanding of what is going on. And numerically, people already empirically found out that there's a very efficient way to do simulations for one-dimensional states. And this was started with the DMRG algorithm, and later it evolved into the TEPP and even MERA algorithm. And more amazingly is that the efficiency of this one-dimensional algorithm based on the general class of matrix product idea can be efficiently proven. The efficiency can be proven, and that is something that doesn't always happen in this manner. But with this nice structure given by matrix product states, we know that these kind of representation can be efficiently found if we're looking at one-dimensional ground states, for example, with a gap.
But it is kind of already some kind of assumption of the structure of the state, right? Because if you like just generic basis, right, it would be coefficient dependent on all i's, right? Not just product in terms of trace.
Yes, exactly. If you're thinking of an arbitrary wave function, then you probably need very, very large matrices.
Because then it would just matrix with all the synthesis, right? One matrix which will get all this m by n, indices, right?
Yes. So it all depends on whether the matrices are simple or not. If the matrices can be as
small as they are. No, but then it's a kind of special basis in this sense, right? Because a special set of wave functions, it's not generic wave function. The one which it presents, represented this way, right? So it's already included in itself, whatever locality or whatever
yes.
You like to call it.
Yes, exactly. So this is good for representing a one-dimensional system with
mm-hmm.
local interaction
mm-hmm.
and also at low energy, especially
mm-hmm.
ground states or some low energy excited states.
I see.
So numerically, it's been known for a while that it's useful for things. And analytically, there has a lot also been a lot of progress in trying to use this kind of structure to understand gap ground states. And by understanding gap ground states using initial spot-up formalism, we were actually able to classify all possible one-dimensional gap phases. So this is just the power of writing wave function in this way. So the next thing that's actually what prompted us to do this work is the so-called matrix product operator. So similar to matrix product states, we can use this formalism to write operators, especially one-dimensional operators. And graphically, we'll just represent it like that. We have the input and output indices, and a set of matrices at each lattice point, and they're contracted left to right, and with periodic boundary condition around the circle. So matrix product operators can be useful in different contexts. For example, we can use them to represent density matrix for 1D system, not just wave functions, but density matrix. And we can use them to describe imaginary time evolution, and these kind of, if we do that, these kind of operators can be useful when we try to find the ground state of the system, when we just apply this operator to whatever matrix product state that we start with. Or we can use matrix product operator to simulate real-time evolution for studying real-time dynamics as a unitary operator. But of course, we can write things like that, but much less structure is known. For example, for matrix product state, there are very powerful theorems about canonical forms, about what kind of states can be represented by a matrix product formalism. And for matrix product operator, even very, very basic questions cannot be answered. For example, if you want to represent it as, say, density matrix, then what kind of operators can represent density matrix, meaning that what kind of matrix product tensor can give you a positive global operator? That turns out to be a very hard question to answer.
But in the way you wrote, it looks like you have kind of dynamics in which you know, particular mode, right? Because it's like dynamics goes in this particular place, right? And then it's factorizable, right? I would say that generically in quantum mechanics, you would not expect this kind of factorization to be preserved by interaction. Okay, it could be a regional basis, but how it, why interaction would preserve this form dynamically?
I'm not sure I understand.
No, because it looks like you have, imagine that you have this A1 acting on I1, okay? And it is, so it's like a kind of dynamics within this particular I1, how it develops without knowledge of other I2, I3, whatever, other, okay. So in this way, it's, I view it as some kind of factorizable expression, right? This wave function, right? But generically, I would not expect the factorizability would be preserved by interaction itself, right?
Yes, exactly. That's a good point. And that's exactly the point of writing the evolution operator as a matrix operator, because if there's no connection, then it's every site evolving by themselves.
Yeah. So what I'm asking, right?
Yes, exactly. That's if you have interaction, generically, we would expect a global evolution to be of this form. And if it's local evolution, then we would expect that this bulk dimension maybe doesn't have to be to capture what the evolution is. So the thing that prompted us to do this work, to use matrix product operator to simulate real-time evolution, is this idea of a periodically driven systems, and so with the so-called flocate phases. So there have been a lot of study in this area recently. It's been a very exciting topic. And the basic setup is that we have a time-dependent drive for a system, and it's periodic. So we do the drive from time 0 to t and repeat it again. And it turns out that a very interesting thing can happen if you consider a system in this setup. So it's not like a ground state equilibrium setup, but a dynamical setup. But even in this dynamical setup, there are various things that people, there are various exotic phenomena that can appear. For example, one is this time crystal, where people talk about discrete time translation symmetry breaking. And there are all these flocate phases, meaning that if we have a periodic drive, and one drive can be different from another drive in some fundamentally disconnected way. Or if there are further symmetry added on top of these periodic drive, then we can talk about symmetry protected flocate phases. So it's still a very much ongoing topic, and there are a lot of progress, not only theoretically but also experimentally, going into this topic. So we decided to think about it and see if we can say anything about these kind of things in the formalism of matrix product operators.
So actually, so for this to happen, right? I mean, one needs an NBL in general for the Turing type system, right? So is there a general relation between matrix product state and NBL in any sense?
Yes.
So far, you haven't assumed any disorder or anything like that, right? So actually.
Yes. So that is a very good question. That if we really want to use the matrix product operator to simulate these dynamics, we need to put in disorder, and so what I'm going to talk about for the rest of the talk does not have this order yet. But I think the result probably will hold if we add this order. That's something we're still working on. But even beyond that, there's a sense that there's some topological number in this matrix product operator formalism. I'll tell you what that is. Maybe that is something that's intrinsic to this matrix product operator, which may survive adding disorder to the system. So this is one particular interesting example of flocate phases where we can see that these, this particular simple drive gives rise to some kind of topological feature, which ends up as some kind of edge states in the system. So we consider a two-dimensional, well, these papers, they consider a two-dimensional square lattice, and they divide the lattice into a piece of lattice, the black one and the white one. And then, this is in one circle of periodic drive, the hopping is induced on bonds of each color alternatively. So we first of all do hopping along the red one, the blue one, the green one, the yellow one, and then finally back. Okay. So what happens in the book is that for each lattice side, there's a hopping in four steps continuously, and in the end, everything that starts from one side ends up at the same lattice side. But what happens on the boundary, if we do have a boundary of the system, then the boundary can only do some of the hopping step. It can, for example, this lattice side cannot hop further to the top. And because of the missing steps in the hopping, then effectively, on the boundary, they're not doing full cycle. And what happens on the boundary is that there's an induced chiral edge space in some sense, but in a very similar way to what we see in a topological equilibrium phase, that the bulk does that looks like trivial, but the boundary state looks, has a very non-trivial property associated with that. In this case, it's the chiral transport of whatever information included in the boundary. So the idea is that if we can use matrix product states to do numerical simulation or classification for zero temperature capped phases, then maybe we can use matrix product unitary operators to do similar things for flocate phases, either in the bulk or on the edge. And that's something we're trying to do. And we're trying to start from very basic questions and see what we can learn about matrix product unitary operator and see how they, what is the power that's endowed within this formalism to allow us to study things like that. So the kind of unitary operator that we're interested in when we do matrix product formalism is the so-called locality preserving unitaries. Now we want to consider one-dimensional unitaries that conjugate a local operator and take it to another local operator. So one class of locality preserving unitary is the so-called finite depth quantum circuit, meaning that I have some local unitaries, and in each layer of the local unitary, they don't overlap, but I can stack these layers of unitary, and unitaries in different layers, they can overlap and not commute with each other. But I can only do this number of layers for a finite number of times and not allow them to go forever. And this kind of finite depth quantum circuit, it's locality preserving because if we conjugate it, if we conjugate an operator by this finite depth circuit, then there's a natural causal point generated by this operator. And you can see that the size of the operator after the conjugation cannot grow too big as long as the depth of the circuit is finite. But there's another interesting thing that can happen if we consider locality preserving unitaries, that is there's this simple operator called translation, which is just taking the whole chain, translate by one step. This is a unitary operator, obviously, and it preserves locality as long as we're translating by a finite step, finite number of steps, because we take one operator and map it to some nearby operator, right? We're not even growing the size. But what's amazing about this translation operator is that it can never be written in a way as a finite depth quantum circuit. It's just there's something intrinsic about translation that doesn't allow us to decompose it into local unitaries and then compose it as a circuit. And this is also why this particular flow cage drive is different from all the other flow cage drives, because on the boundary there's this one-step translation going on. If we do one period of driving, that because in the bulk, when we're doing the drive, we're basically doing finite depth quantum circuit, right? We're doing four depths of quantum circuit. So in the bulk, everything's a circuit, but on the boundary, it becomes a non-circuit, even though it's still locality preserving. And that's why it's different from all the other drives, where on the boundary, it's still a finite depth quantum circuit. So these kind of unitaries, it has been studied in the under the context of so-called cellular automata by these four people, David Gross, Watts and Werner in 2012, where they proved some quite amazing theorems, where they were able to show that all one-dimensional locality preserving unitaries are either finite depth circuits, or their translation, or a combination of the two. So there's not much going on beyond that. It's any of the three options. And if we think of finite depth quantum circuit as a trivial way as compared to translation, then we actually classify all these locality preserving unitaries using this equivalence condition by undercomposition with finite depth circuit. So we think of finite depth quantum circuit as trivial, and if we add trivial things to another thing, we remain in the same class. Then under this equivalence relation, we can decompose the whole set of locality preserving unitary into classes such that each class can be indexed by a positive rational, and this positive rational is basically capturing how much translation is going on. Because finite depth circuit doesn't induce translation, and translation has an intrinsic property that will be captured by this positive rational number.
So why is there a rational? Because it was an integer originally when you translated. Where does the other integer come from?
Yes, that's what I'm explaining on this slide. So this is what I'm going to call the GMVW index, because the initial of the four people. And this index is exactly indicating how much translation is going on. So suppose we start from a one-dimensional chain where each lattice I contains a finite dimensional Hilbert space. And if it's translation by one lattice step onto the left of a p-dimensional Hilbert space, then the index is going to be p. And if it's translation to the right by of a q-dimensional Hilbert space, the index is going to be 1 over q. And if it's a composite of translation both to the right and to the left at the same time, then the index is p over q. And because of that, it's a positive rational number. And of course, these are the minimum version of the locality preserving unitary in each class. On top of that, we can composite it with any number of finite exponent circuit, and in between or in whatever way, and that's not going to change the index at all.
Sorry. Yeah, why? So that it's one step to the left and one step to the right in both cases? That's right.
Yes.
But the Hilbert space it acts on is p-dimensional at every site?
Yes.
Or q-dimensional at every site?
Yes.
Why does one consider different p and q? They're not operators within some fixed Hilbert space?
Oh, like in this case, it's the Hilbert space, the tensor product between the p-dimensional and the q-dimensional.
Okay.
Together, and you can translate like that. Yeah. So they don't have to be the same.
But one Hilbert space you can only translate to the right, and
yeah.
The other is that one?
Yeah, you cannot do. Maybe Marama will be able to translate, but that's also weird. Sorry, I shouldn't mention that. But usually we just translate whole Hilbert space all together.
So you can say that if it's what? Two integer numbers, p and q, because the fact that we put it in form of the fraction, it doesn't matter, right? It's just still two integer translation, or it's not true.
Sorry?
No, I mean, you can view it as a p translation one direction and q translation another direction, right? So in this way, it's like both integer numbers, putting them in the index in terms of fraction, it's just a way to write it. Fraction has meaning, is what I'm asking.
Yes, that's a good question. So, of course, this is by now just definition, but to make connection with the equivalence class, there is a way to calculate this index for whatever locality preserving unitary, such that for the unitary in that class,
I see. So you mean that, say, when q is equal p over 2, the index would be equal to 2, right? If q is equal p over 2, for example.
Yes.
Yeah, so in this way, there is this equivalence, right? So
yes, so that's equivalent to translation to the left of a two-dimensional Hilbert space after this composition of
So physically, how do I understand? So what you're doing is that you fractionalize a Hilbert space into two parts and you translate one.
Isn't it like having left and right movers in field theory? Is that how I should think about it? That have different degrees of freedom? Or is that not inaccurate?
Yeah, so it's a composite, it's a tensor product between degrees of freedom that's moving left and right. It's not left and right mover, sorry. It's the total Hilbert space is p-dimensional and q-dimensional.
So you could say one is the Hilbert space of the left movers and one the right movers, and the unitary is just evolution where they do their left or right motion. Right?
Yeah, usually when we say left and right movers, we're talking about some low energy vacuum theory, and they come out of the same degree of freedom, like fermions or bosons at each left-hand side.
Not necessarily.
Or it could be like there's one set of degree of freedom having left and right mover, or another set of degree of freedom having left and right mover. So here, it's two sets of degrees of freedom, the blue one and the yellow one. And it's like a fermion Hilbert space and a boson Hilbert space. They don't quite talk to each other. And there's no Hamiltonian. There's no low energy effective field theory. It's just the unitary is doing translation altogether.
So maybe another way of asking the question that seems to be in many minds here. So if we double both p and q, why is the index the same? Is there some simple way of understanding why there's a ratio?
Oh, you mean if we take the unit cell to be...
p goes to 2p, q goes to 2q. I doesn't change. Why?
P goes to 2p, q goes to 2q. All right, yes, so because, so that's saying that I also attach within a qubit and translate to the left, and attach with this one, the qubit, and translate to the left, but that counter-translation can be canceled with some finite depth circuit, because if you translate to the left and right, then you can do something to remove it.
That almost looks like an anomaly or something.
Yeah, right. So all the questions are probably related, and you probably will explain later as well. So let me try to understand here. So normally one translation will correspond, one translation will correspond to conserved momentum, right? Actually, so now you have like a, so it looks like now you have like a, you know, you actually make one local Hilbert space into two your product of the two different Hilbert space, and each of them you have your own independent conserved momentum.
I don't have a Hamiltonian, I don't have anything. I'm a little confused
on a similar, I mean, I don't know if it's related, but you know, usually when we talk about translations, we think about translation as a symmetry, which is part of a group.
Yeah.
And so there's, in a group, we have an inverse, and the translation to the left, the inverse is a translation to the right.
So it really feels like that you are, I mean, so your P and Q dimensional Hilbert space, you are really separating them in a two boundary of system. So each of them will have its own translation and their own conserved boundary, its own conserved momentum. Can I think of that way? Or otherwise, actually, when the two systems, two P and Q Hilbert space, start to interact with each other, so the set of the Fermi bosons start to interact with each other, I really cannot imagine why I can define a left moving translation for one Hilbert space and right moving translation for another. I mean, right translation for another Hilbert space. So once they start talking to each other, right?
What's fundamental about left or right? If I have an inverse, I can just.
Yeah, but
right.
But look, if you take log of I, right, it would be what you said. It would be log of P minus log of Q, right? Yeah. So it would be, you know, how much to shift to the right minus how much to shift to the left.
Well, that's like a difference in central charges if this were.
No, I mean, if I consider log of I instead of I, I mean, it's, no, so it would be difference of two operations. So this, it fits this idea that it is kind of conjugated to each other, right?
To answer Tinker's question, this is not this is upper boundary, this is, well, if you think of it as a boundary of a disk, of this two-dimensional comp, it's just still translated in one direction, all going entirely. Does that make sense? So, what I'm talking about here is literally two sets of degrees of freedom, and you can think of them as other translation.
Sure, but once they start interacting with each other, so does this whole formula still hold? Or so you keep saying that.
I think that's why you make the ratio P over Q rather than P over Q separate. This is what I try to say, basically, right? That's why you have only the ratio P over Q rather than P and Q independently.
If you rescale P to 2P and Q to 2P.
Because you turn on interactions,
reduced
to that.
Going
back to the answer,
by some local
energy. So here is a composite with finite circuit.
Right. So I guess right. That's the answer you gave me. So to multiply by an integer, you can just duplicate or triplicate your little lines and transform it away with your finite depth similarity.
Right.
So you multiply by integer just by making these lines composites and then transform them away. And that's why it's a ratio.
So multiply, I'm not sure exactly understand the question, let me try to see what I understood. If you multiply by two here, it's not like you have two yellow lines. It's you have a yellow line and then you have a qubit line. So it's a tensor product of the dimension of the Hilbert space. But then there's a qubit line here, and a qubit line here, and when you do a composite, they will cancel out. Is that the... Does it make sense now? Make better sense? Right. So, let me say what is... how this index... Well, we gave examples of how this index should be, but of course, in general, we have just some description of locality preserving unitary, and there should be a way to extract this index, no matter how complicated this unitary looks like. And that this is the formalism.
Sorry, just very, very dumb question. So, this can be negative?
No, just positive.
Just positive?
Yeah, positive rational numbers.
But
the law
could be negative. Well, I mean, it means that the log, in some sense, is the right thing to think about. Yeah. It's how much information is going, being pumped with each cycle of the cloquet. And the negative and positive means moving to the left or right.
I think in the original paper, maybe they did take a log, but yeah, to compare it to the M matrix product operator, we
I guess if you have anything that's like everything going to the right, you just shunt it all into one.
Yeah.
They call the other one zero.
So the way to extract this index in that GMEW paper is to make a cut in the one-dimensional chain and take a large enough Hilbert space here to the left and take a large enough Hilbert space to the right and compare these two Hilbert spaces after the after the locality preserved unitary. So basically we do this unitary, map this left-hand side Hilbert space to something and compare it to the right-hand side Hilbert space. So this eta is basically calculating the overlap between the two Hilbert spaces. And this number is going to give you the P over Q, no matter how complicated this O looks like. It might contain a lot of finite depth quantum circuit, or it might contain counterpropagating Hilbert space of the same dimension that's going to cancel out. But in the end, this calculation is going to tell you what this index is. And if it's the same index, then the locality preserved unity belongs to the same universality class in the equivalent under composition with finite depth circuit.
So the ALs and ARs, what is the relationship with the tensor products on the previous slide? It was a local splitting of a Hilbert space into whatever, two Hilbert spaces.
Each of the dot is a local Hilbert space.
Okay.
So this is local Hilbert space on the left hand side. This is local Hilbert space on the right hand side. And so they correspond to.
They correspond to these things. Okay.
Yeah, this is from local Hilbert space.
Sorry, and eta is the action of this unitary. Oh no, eta is the subject.
No, O is this unitary. O is the unitary that calculates that Hilbert space, that maps it to something. And in the calculation, you actually take the operator, basis for the operator space, and do the computation and compare it to the operator basis on the other side. So either it's just comparing the overlap between the Hilbert space after the calculation. Okay. So, this is well understood, and our question is about how can we see the story using matrix product operators. Hopefully that can give us some numerical tool, analytical tool along the way, but we're starting from very simple questions. For example, can locality preserving unitaries all be represented in a matrix product tool? And on the other hand, if we have a matrix product operator, what kind of property, what kind of condition does it to satisfy in order to be locality preserving? And maybe it can be something totally crazy. And certainly, if we can answer the first two questions, then within the class of locality preserving unitaries, is there a simple way to extract this GMEW index? Simple meaning that we just want to deal with the set of matrices on a single lattice site. And that is something that's that's nice about the matrix product representation, that it reduces a one-dimensional many-body thing to just a local stuff. But maybe from this local stuff, we can already extract the GMEW. So this, of course, is we have some intuition about why this probably could be done, because for matrix product states, we know that because these matrices we use are simple 2x2, 3x3, finite dimensional matrices, it gives rise to a certain nice properties for the states that it represents. For example, it has these kind of matrix product states all have a finite entanglement satisfying the area law in your dimension. And it has a finite correlation lens under some generic conditions for the matrix product states that we're representing gapped ground states. And the finite correlation lens, if we represented in a graphical way, It looks like this. So this is the computation of the a correlator between operator O1 and O2, and the up and down are the Kettenbrock states. And the finite correlation length basically means that if O1 and O2 are far away from each other, then the whole diagram factorizes into two pieces, right? The expectation value on the left-hand side and on the right-hand side. So this tells us that matrix Planck states captures some of the locality structure of local Hamiltonian and also at low energies. It captures the finite correlation length, the finite entanglement of Brown states. And that is something that we would expect for the matrix product operator as well, that because we're using these finite dimensional matrices at each ladder site, maybe intrinsically the formalism would be nice to capture some kind of locality structure, and in this case it will be the locality preserving property for unitaries. And indeed, we were able to answer these questions, so let me give you an overview of what our result is. We were able to show that, first of all locality preserving unitaries can be represented in a matrix product form. This is actually a simple first step. And a more non-trivial conclusion is that all matrix product operators, as long as they're unitary, they preserve locality. So as long as we're talking about unitary operators, we don't need to worry about them not preserving locality. They automatically belong to this class. So unitarity is sufficient to guarantee locality preserving. And we find a very simple and nice way to extract the GMBW index from the representation. Sorry, it's not the matrix product state, but matrix product operator representation. And this is the diagram that we use to calculate the index. So basically, as a matrix product operator, what we have on each ladder side is a full index tensor. It has an input physical index and an output physical index, and the left and right indices being contracted. And if we just do an SVD decomposition in these two diagonal ways and calculate the rank, then the ratio of the rank has a correspondence. It's basically the GMBW index squared, and this is what we can prove. So this summarizes our result, that and there's one-to-one correspondence between matrix by unitary operator and locality preserving unitaries, and also there's a simple way to extract this index. So, yes.
So the matrix product unitary operators, do you have an easy way of telling locally whether a matrix product operator is unitary?
Yes, that's a good question. So ideally, what I would like is to find the set of parameterization that I can directly tell whether it's a unitary. But of course, for this step, what we know is that we can check. We can take the basically, it's not here yet. We basically take the operator and make it into basically to locally to U and U dagger, and we can put it into canonical form and see if it's a unitary, if it's equivalent to identity. That can be done locally, but that's not as ideal as I want. Right, so first let me tell you about the first part, that this matrix product operator has a correspondence to locality preserving unitaries. So so now I'm getting into more of the technical part of the talk. I don't plan to explain to you all the technicalities, because it's actually a pretty lengthy proof. It took us more than 10 pages to write everything down. But I'll try to give you the general sense of why this makes sense, and but while omitting all the complications that we hit in the paper. So the first thing is to show that all locality preserving unitaries can be represented in a matrix product form, and that is actually the simple part, because we know that locality preserving unitaries, if you can deal with finite depth circuit, if you can deal with translation, then you're done, because you can just put things together and get everything. So we only need to find a matrix product representation for the finite depth circuit, and that can be done because for each of the two-body unitary, we can write it in a matrix product form. So this is input, output, physical index, and with some internal indices connecting the two sides. And then if you put everything together, this is a nice looking matrix product operator, even though it's missing some bonds, but that's due to this structure.
This is a really dumb question. Can you define locality preserving for us again?
Oh, okay. So you so it's a one-dimensional unitary, and if you use it to conjugate a local operator, exactly local. On a nearby region on the finite sense. So translation cannot be translation by half system size. It's translation by system. If it's for translation by half system size, it's too far away. Okay, so a finite circuit is easy to deal with, but translation is not that much harder. Translation is represented simply by a matrix product operator graph. So the first line represents the identity of 0, 0, plus 1, 1, plus 2, 2, for example. And if we connect them all together, we can see why this is translation, because it's taking information from one added side, putting it in a horizontal way, and then getting it out on a nearby line. So this is simple, and then by composing, because we know that all locality preserving unitaries is basically composed of finite depth circuit and translation, and we get everything, we see that all the locality preserving unitaries can be written in a form as finite dimensional matrix product operator. And also this composition can only be finite layers. We cannot do, we cannot go on, the layer cannot scale with system size.
So you're using heavily the results of this PNBW and all of the other features that you're in this.
So the other direction is to say that a matrix product unitary operator are automatically locality preserving, and this is more non-trivial than the previous part. And I'll try to illustrate why this is something that that's plausible. Because graphically, it's actually very easy to believe that this is true, even though it took us a while to get the proof correct. So by being a unitary, basically what we mean is that we compose U and U dagger and we get identity. It's a bunch of identity at each level. So the condition of operator being unitary. And if that is the case, now we can deduce some kind of graphical conditions on the set of tensors locally. So one condition is separation, that if we have tensor, this U and U dagger tensor, on two lattice sets, and then they can separate. And the second one is isometry, that if we have one circle circling one lattice side, it's equivalent to identity. And then this pulling through, meaning that if we have two and then an enclosure from the left hand side, we can pull it and leave the identity on the lattice side that's on the way. So these graphical conditions give us a very nice handle to try to prove that matrix product unitary operator is locality preserving. And it's actually, so there's a if and only if condition between these two, but it's actually pretty complicated to go this direction, and if I want to go that direction, I'll need to go into a lot of theorem about matrix product representation, and I don't want to do that. I'll just try to show you why this direction makes sense. Okay? Why, if we have all these conditions, then the operator is a naturally a unitary, and also why it's a locality preserving unitary. So to see it's unitary is actually easy. We just see that we can use this separation condition and break the whole contraction into two parts, right? And then we can use the pulling through condition to pull this fly and catch to either directions. And finally, because of the periodic condition, they are actually going to meet together at one lattice side. But at one lattice side, we're going to use this isometry condition, and finally we get everything. We get everything equal to identity, meaning that the operator is a unitary. And that also leads to the property of locality preserving, because locality preserving means we need to consider a diagram where we have one impurity operator in the middle, that is the operator being conjugated by the integer. And similarly, we can use the separation condition, but on two sides of this impurity tensor. And now we can pull through and finally use the isometry condition and leaving all the tensors on the side to be identity. So after this operation, then this middle thing may be a non-trivial thing. So this one-body operator may grow into a three-body operator, but it's still a local operator. And everywhere else is identity, and that's all we need to show locality preserved. And this is similar to what we see in matrix product states, where we have this decomposition of correlation functions. In matrix product states, we know it's a finite correlation mess, so the calculation for the connected correlator actually decomposed into two parts. And here it looks very, very similar, except that we have this physical input and output in the system. We're not into the same thing. And that actually leads to a complication of the proof. But practically, I'm just trying to show this to convince you that this is something that's reasonable. And the second part is about how to extract the index, the GMBW index. To understand why the way of doing this SVD decomposition and taking the ratio of the rank works, we can just look at simple cases of, first of all, this finite edge circuit, again, using the result of GMBW that we can think of things in terms of finite edge circuit and translation and put it together. So for finite edge circuit, we take one elementary block out of the matrix product representation, which is this structure. If we put this structure periodically, we get a full matrix product operator. And now we can do the SVD decomposition, one like this and the other one like that, and calculate the rank. So one simplification we can do in a process is to realize that this H structure on the upper level, this is just a unitary. And unitary doesn't change the result of SVD decomposition, so we can just throw it away. So we can simplify things to the SVD decomposition of two separate parts, one on the left and one on the right. And we're doing SVD this way and SVD that way, and these two have the same rank. So this is easy to believe, but in the proof, there is some tricky part. So if you really want to see how this works out, you can read that paper. But you can maybe easy to believe that this is actually equal to 1, which is the trivial index of in the GMBW, and it's actually the square. Of course, here 1 is equal to 1 squared, so I don't really need the square. But in the next slide, I will see you will see that this square actually is necessary there. And that's because in translation, we can do the same computation. We can take the SVD in two different ways and calculate the ratio of the rank. And if the dimension of the index is q, then what we get is q squared over 1. And this is the square of the GMBW. So we did finite edge circuit, we did translation, and then we put them together and prove something else, that the index actually multiplied when we are composing this unitary. So this is an extra step in our proof. And finally, we get to the conclusion that this way of calculating the index from local tensors in the representation gives us the square of the GMBW index. And because this is positive rational, so there's a bunch of reference points. But surprisingly, there's actually something else. Now we realize in the process, even though the story looks pretty simple and boring, right? And that all matrix by unitary operators are just reciprocal learning, we ran into a couple of students and realized that with just some simple relaxation of the condition, we can actually get something beyond the framework. So we found one example, and later generalized to many others, of matrix product operator that's unitary in a slightly relaxed sense, that it's unitary on all system sides, but not on even system sides. On even system sides, it's not quite unitary. But then this unitary, it breaks the previous condition that it's unitary on all system size and becomes normal preserving. It's finding normal locality preserving, and if you calculate the index.
So what does that mean? You mean it's not locality preserving? Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Third order locality.
Yes, because if you conjugate local operator, it becomes normal.
So even operator, I mean, it's unitary on, I mean, whether operator is unitary or not, depending on the system size, it's very, very now local anyway, right?
Yeah, it's
also about the global structure of the system, count the number of sites very precisely.
Therefore,
I guess
you can also come up with unitaries that satisfy the first two conditions, but
still,
so, this is a particular example. Maybe it doesn't make much sense as the way I write it, but if we try to, this is the way it maps the operators. If you put it one sigma x, it becomes the whole chain of sigma x and sigma x squared. Not sigma x, sorry. This is the qubit. This is the three-dimensional x. And then if you put in a z part is still local. It's just from one body becomes two body. And if you calculate the index is 3. And remember that the correspondence to GMVW index is squared. So the GMVW index, if there's a GMVW index, it will be square root of 3. And this is not allowed because GMVW index is always a positive rational number. And this is square root. So this is just saying that even though we have already have a good understanding of how the matrix by unitary operator corresponds to locality preserving unitaries and how we can extract the index, in order to answer that question of, for example, what kind of, if we want to do a simulation of, say, flow-kit phases, then we would want a numerical way to generate variational assets, for example, right, of this matrix. Then we would want to know what is the parameterization of the tensor that we need to put into a computer in order to actually have locality preserving unitaries. So, of course, those non-locality preserving unitaries, for right now, I don't have a good motivation to study them, but at least they would tell us what are the things that we should exclude when trying to parameterize these locality preserving unitaries. Because on the level of these tensors, operator tensors, they have very similar properties to the ones that we see before. Only if we put them together, then we see that they have this non-local structure. So they might, by studying these examples beyond the framework, might lead to an answer to that question of how can we tell whether we immediately tell whether we have a unitary operator and locality preserving of all of this system size. Alright, so then starting from there, hopefully we'll be able to address questions about flow-kit phases, and of course then we would need to put in this order. But this index, even though the theorems we're proving now is for translation invariant representation, I do believe that it should carry over even to the case of different ways to resolve. For example, the matrix product state representation of SPP phases, for example. All the proofs are based on translation invariant matrices, but actually nothing depends on translation invariant. We only need to take one set of matrices and do the symmetry and see what the fractional, the projective representation comes out. And here, I do believe that it should be a simple story that even if the proof we have currently depends on the symmetry, we can generalize it to make an index totally obvious. But this way of extracting the index should still work because all of this order comes in the way of finite depth circuit, right? We can have different local unitaries at different levels. But translation is translation on the whole system together. So this way of extracting index with some kind of topological feature for the matrix for an operator, but doesn't mean it shouldn't be transitive. So to summarize, I'm right on time. This is work done with Burak, with postdoc and IQIM and Suki and Kong for the graduate student at IQIM, and our paper was on archive in April while there was an earlier paper by Siraj Perez Garcia, Norbert Schulf, and Fred Restrada on a very similar topic on matrix productivity, where they also study this structure and comparison in the PLDW index, how to extract them from the matrix. So if you're interested, you can go check out. Thank you.
So we have a little time for questions. I don't think we can linger very long because of the Blackboard lunch.
What's known about higher dimensions? So in 1D, it's known that it's just translations. So.
Yeah, in higher dimensions, even this GLBW generalization is hard.
Are there any partial results in higher dimensions? Well, are there examples of things that aren't? Hmm? Are there examples in higher dimensions of locality preserving interiors that aren't just translations in finite jet circuits?
Yeah, because in higher dimension, you can imagine that you can have translation in orthogonal directions, and I think they're struggling with how to put them in discrete classes. But whether there are things...
What about rotations?
Rotation is, in a sense, not kind of preserving, because if you're far away from the center,
it does map local to local.
And that's like a translation by half system
type.
So somehow, if you have a, let's say, three-dimensional block of locate point, it's not going to
So that even comes up in 1D, right? Like a 1D reflection you wouldn't call locality preserving?
Sorry?
Like a reflection in 1D is not locality preserving?
Reflection? Yeah. It's not going to happen in the boundary. Otherwise, why do we want to consider the sense of locality? But so 2D is hard, like in general for text, it's hard for transdimensional representation, but maybe in 1D we can add symmetry to the story. And so this paper talks something about symmetry, but it doesn't seem to be related to the symmetric flow k phases in a natural way. So the interesting thing we're looking at is how to add symmetric flow k phases.
Maybe we should just thank Sharon again.